8:47. Those members present are Representative Ringstad, Cowdery, Yoring, and Sherman Furnace. First piece of legislation for consideration is Senate Bill 188, an act relating to bank holding companies. The prime sponsor is Senator Rohde. And is the senator going to be here, or Jim Kelly, or whatever? All right, let's recognize Mr. Kirkpatrick from the Division of Banking and Securities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Willis Kirkpatrick. I'm Director of Banking Securities for the State of Alaska. I'd like to testify in favor of passage of Senate Bill 188. To be very brief on it, it was an error and an oversight on our part when the bank, out-of-state bank provisions were passed last year. It was the purpose not to allow out-of-state bank holding companies to purchase a state bank unless that state bank had been in existence for 3 years. And somehow the drafters of the legislation put some limiting words into the domestic bank holding company. And so early last year we had a domestic bank holding company formed to form Alaska Continental Bank. And we found out halfway through the application that they were prohibited by state law, this language of forming a state bank. And that's one of the purposes of a domestic bank holding company. And so we would like to have that language dropped out so that a domestic bank holding company can form or purchase a new bank. This still prohibits an out-of-state bank holding company from purchasing, it has no effect on the out-of-state bank holding company's prohibition. So on that, I would urge that you give this favorable consideration.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Ringstad?
Mr. Patrick, this provision disallowing or requiring a three-year time period, that was just when it was last year's
yes.
banking change for the interstate banking?
Yes.
Was there, previous to that then, there was no time delay in there? Has there been any problem with banks doing that?
No.
Previous to the
no.
change?
Prior to last year, there were banks formed by bank holding companies. I think APB is one that was formed, and Alaska State Bank was purchased on the basis of a bank holding company.
Was this another bill that was just changed? Is this is the bracketed unless the bank is originally formed back?
Okay, those were the words that were put in last year, and we would like to delete them from existing law.
This is the new language that you recommended to read. So the section B is in the current statute. These words were, I just meant to put in, and what they out of it.
Yeah, the words are there now, unless the bank is a recently formed bank, and those words in the existing law prohibit a domestic bank holding company from forming a new state bank. This has an additional effect, is that the Comptroller of Currency, and the Federal Reserve, when they're dealing with this type of language, has no prohibition. So if this continues on the state book, then this will force them into the state, a proposed state charter into a national charter, so it makes it discriminatory against state chartered financial institutions.
There's no question. Let the record show that Representative Copeland is with us at this time. We will hold Senate Bill 188 has to do with an act related to a bank holding company. In the case of Alaska Continental Bank, what happened considering that they were prohibited from establishing a domestic bank holding company? What happened to that?
Okay, the progression of that is that the promoters did form a bank holding company under Title 10, and it was an operating corporation. It obtained the real estate, did the financing for the bank, and then when they sent in the bank application, we found out by the review and the investigation of the application, we found out that they were prohibited from forming a bank with a bank holding company. So what they had to do is that they, the individual then had to step outside the bank holding company provision and start the bank on their own as individuals. The bank still did form, but now we have a shell corporation that had expenses and liabilities in the organization that is now in the process of being disbanded. The bank still did form, but not through the bank holding company. Did that answer your question?
Yes. So that is the question. It is the decision of the chair to pass this bill for doing that. Let's see. Is there anyone else here to provide testimony for Senate Bill 188? If not, the chairman accept the motion at this time. Is there an objection? If not, so be it. Legislation is House Bill 389, it's an act relating to the regulation of real estate, brokers and sellers. We do have one person to be heard on this legislation, Mr. Jim McDonald. So, would you go to the table at this time? For the record, if you will identify yourself, spell your last name and who you represent.
James McGowan, M-A-G-O-W-A-N, and I'm the Executive Director of the Real Estate Commission in the Department of Commerce.
You then review the your comments with the committee.
Okay, on 389, okay, most of these changes are pretty much the nature of housekeeping, clean up the statute, you know, eliminate, there's one section there, 261, which has been inoperative for about 5 years, and it's just time to get it out. Okay, in section one, the addition there of adding the authority to reprimand the license or licensee. We have a pretty heavy caseload of minor infractions and violations which don't justify the hammer of revoking or suspending a license, but if you just ignore it, people think that the law is unimportant.
What do you have in mind as far as the reprimand?
Basically just a letter saying you know on inspection we found that you didn't keep your records properly and you're hereby reprimanded and advised to keep them properly in the future. The way this would probably work based on our experience so far is if it's a clear-cut technical violation, the licensees are probably not going to fight very hard against a reprimand, which simply says you did it and correct it when they're going to correct it. We have found even in other situations when it's relatively clear cut and we're not going to interfere with people's earning a living, that they will usually stipulate or agree to some kind of minor sanction so that we can all just get on with our business. And having something of less severity.
Mm-hmm. Another question on that point from Wilson County.
Well, not on that particular point. I'll wait till
before the president.
What?
You
forgot who I was.
Let the record show that we have a new member on the committee this morning, Representative Winting. That's spelled W-E-N-T-E.
V-T-E.
V-T-E. Thank you. Continue, the new representative.
The what is a reprimand? Write a letter and say you've been a bad boy and go do your work again?
Yeah, basically what it's saying is you didn't comply with the law in this particular situation, but and it's just making it a matter of record that there has been a violation, that the violation has been corrected, so to speak. Right now, we have many situations where we just say, gee, we don't have time to hold a hearing, and we'll never revoke a license for this, so there's no point in doing a prosecution. It's kind of like right now, all we have is a hammer. We don't have a rap on the knuckles, so to speak. And we have actually found, I've seen situations where minor violations go undisciplined, so to speak, and the result is that the licensee gets the idea that the law is not an important thing to pay attention to and to follow, and later on, just by sloppy business practices and things that don't get corrected, they wind up getting into a serious violation. A member of the public gets seriously injured. And these are basically, good people, but you're leading people astray if you don't enforce the law. And you give them the wrong impression when you don't enforce minor points and say, we're not going to do anything until you do something real bad. That would be like not enforcing drunk driving laws until you kill somebody.
In a situation like that, Mr. McGowan, when a person's license comes up for renewal, is that every 2 years, I believe?
Yes.
Is that letter taken in consideration upon a renewal? Is it feasible that a person could be denied a renewal of license if there was accumulation of the same violation or a multitude of violations?
That's a kind of a yes and no. If there's accumulation of letters in the file, then we could take the cumulative effect of these letters and say this is a person who just won't obey the law, and then we could move to hold a hearing to revoke or suspend that license based on the cumulative record. And that would probably happen when we get one more violation. We'd say, well, gee, we've got 10 in the file. Here's another one under investigation. We don't think that reprimands are really doing the job here, and this person is likely to go out and injure the public. We couldn't just because there's letters in there refuse the license. We have to follow the Administrative Procedure Act.
Yes, it's on a little further in the bill on page 2.
Why don't we do the time?
Okay.
Interrupted the gentleman.
Yeah.
But you go through with your presentation, and we'll come back to the question.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, in
section 2, adding new paragraph to read violates the provision of this chapter. We've had an ongoing problem with the statute because our attorneys tell us that
when you have a statute that says you have to do all kinds of things, and then you have one section there that says if you do these things, your license can be disciplined. You can't discipline for anything else. And so we sometimes have to infer things or really look awfully hard to find a violation under Section 071 when they're not doing something that's covered in another section of the statute. And basically what this says is that discipline can be imposed upon a licensee for violating any section of the statute. It's an umbrella discipline clause.
Which one is that?
Section 2 in the bill. It would be I in the statute. Okay, now here, I was just advised by our attorney that if we are going to amend things, that we would recommend the addition of a, actually would be a new Section 3, because it would be an amendment to Section 081. And that amendment would read, the Commission shall also adopt regulations to carry out the other purposes of this chapter.
Our regulation section was changed in 1980 in the course of our sunset review because it was kind of poorly written and didn't really say what was intended. And now the AG's office is telling us it still doesn't. And all of the other statutes for licensing boards and commissions read this way, and it's a cleaner language. Right now, apparently, with some of our regulations, they have to infer the authority from the statute rather than the statute just clearly saying it. So it's simply language cleanup. It's saying we can do what we are doing and what is inferred from the statute. That was just given to me by the attorney. That would just be adding a problem B. The statute as it reads says the Commission shall adopt regulations pertaining to the responsibilities of persons licensed and grounds for revoking or suspending a license.
Give a copy of that amendment. He's running a copy of that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Section 3 this section was discussed at several commission meetings, and as it is in the statute, it's not precisely what the commission had been looking at, and I don't know whether what they're looking at is proper or not. The commission publishes various manuals and texts and things. These manuals are produced, printed, and distributed under funding from the Real Estate Surety Fund. The Surety Fund is a special fund. Each licensee, each time they renew, pays a fee into the fund. And that fund is maintained, accounted for separately within the general fund. And the money that is paid into that, it's not the license fee, it's a surety fee. And that money is to provide recovery to members of the public who are injured. And the statute also provides that money from the fund can be used to put on educational programs, which basically is to enhance the confidence. In other words, preventive medicine as well as curative medicine. That's the way I look at it. The licensees feel, understandably, that they kind of had a vested interest in this fund because it was through their
initial pushing everything, that the fund was initiated, and they pay this money every 2 years, and these educational materials are not restricted in any way. Anybody that walks in the office can get copies of these manuals and things. We have, for instance, the trust account manual, which is, from all the reports I've gotten, it's the best manual of its kind in the country. And real estate schools and stuff would love to have this used in their classes. I have no objection to them using it, but I don't feel it's proper for me to hand somebody that walks in 200 copies of this thing. We actually have about probably $10 a copy in the manual. That money came from the surety fund. The commission's initial idea was that we charge something for these manuals in bulk quantity so that if the school wants it, they can have it. And they pay back the cost. When they pay back the cost, the question is, does that money go into the general fund for other purposes, or does that money go back into the surety fund? So the commission had originally looked at this section as a recovery to the surety fund. In other words, if somebody pays for a manual, that's considered a refund to the surety fund. Otherwise, what is happening is we're actually converting surety fund money to general fund money when we sell the copy. Doing that would be better than not having any recovery, because at least when the schools come in and want 200 copies, we can give it to them. It goes into revenue, and we can show at least that, you know, we're paying our bills. The fairest thing would be to put it back in the surety fund if that is constitutionally permissible. And I would leave the decision on that to the committee, because I'm not a constitutional expert. But in any case, the basic idea here is to have these manuals available to anyone that wants them in any quantity, as long as they're willing to pay the costs if they want in bulk quantity. All right, in section 4, this again is a section that the commission has had numerous discussions and hearings. We've had several presentations from members of IREM, which is the Institute of Real Estate Management, which is a division of the National Association of Realtors. These are people who specialize in property management. The section, as was proposed by IREM and endorsed by the commission, was to counteract a growing problem in Alaska, particularly in Anchorage right now that we know of, in condominiums. In condominiums, I'll give you one example. The roof on a condominium is common property, so to speak, because it covers all of the units. Every once in a while, a roof has to be replaced. And when you replace a roof on a condominium, you're talking about many thousands of dollars. And you're talking about some time down the pipe. So what happens is, in the condominium dues that people pay each month, a certain amount of it is supposed to go into a reserve account to build up money so when the roof needs to be replaced, everybody doesn't get hit with a $10,000 assessment. It may be 15 or 10 or 20 years before that roof gets replaced, so this reserve account builds over a long period of time. It's an absolute setup for embezzlement. And we just recently had a conviction in Anchorage of a condominium manager who embezzled two associations, one of them for, I think, $12,000 and the other for $11,000. He was convicted of embezzling $22,000, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. And this person, by the way, is not, as far as we can tell, a thief. This was a person who just got into some binds, and here was this money, and he had access to it. He took it and then couldn't put it back, and they went and said, hey, people, this is what I did. And my last communication with him is he's not licensed, never was licensed, and he's apparently trying to pay back the money. He has been convicted and he's on probation. He wasn't sentenced to jail because he was making restitution. If this person had been licensed, he would have been covered by our trust account rules and regulations and would have been required to keep this money in the proper account. he would have been better advised as to his fiduciary responsibility to people. His fiduciary responsibility is the heart of the real estate industry. And as such, he might have avoided making the mistake, and if he didn't avoid making it, the associations would have had access to recovery from the surety fund, so that the public wouldn't be hurting if he is unable for a period of time to pay the money back. And by the way, when we pay out of the fund, we do have recourse against the person against whom the money is paid.
Just to get on that point, question,
yes, on that section four. What effect is this going to have on the mom and pop operations throughout the state? A lot of mom and pop manage their apartments for supplementing their income and things like that. I think it might be a of a burden to that type of situation, being a condominium management. Not all professional managers,
We've taken that into account in two things. Basically, I'll answer that and explain. The commission would recommend modifying this. First of all, drop the full compensation, and I'll explain that in a minute, and add to it, you know, commercial or residential real estate or condominium associations or similar associations. The problem is that we're inventing new kinds of real estate. We're calling condominiums townhouses and whatever. And we want the law to include those for public protection without having to come up with a new law every time somebody calls it something different. Now, as far as the mom and pop operations are concerned, we have Section 421, which provides various exceptions to the law. And one of those exceptions is for a resident property manager. And a resident property manager can work either directly for the owner or for a real estate broker. This is the one instance in which a real estate broker, for instance, can employ an unlicensed person. They must be residents in the complex or on the property. There's also an exception in there for acting in the power of attorney. For instance, if I had property and I wanted one of my daughters to manage it, I could hire her. I could just draft power of attorney, give her power of attorney over that piece of property, and she would be completely covered. And the law says you can do that twice a year per person. I have two daughters, so I could have up to four properties which they are not resident in, managed by them. And if they reside in the property, I could have another two properties, you know, each one of them living on it. So we're pretty well covered there.
And the problem that we run into, if we try to make a real blanket exception for mom and pop things, is the unscrupulous type people are always looking for loopholes, and they find them. The compensation, that's the reason I recommend deleting that, is as soon as you say for compensation, they work out some kind of a scheme where they're not being directly compensated, and they say, I'm not being paid, so why should I have to be licensed? My response is that I have never seen any evidence that people are more competent when they're not paid.
If I could follow up. But on the same token, it's possible, like, say, I know of a situation where couple of brothers and another person own apartment complex, sixplexes, eightplexes, and they're not adjoining, and they've hired one kind of a mom and pop that's living in one of them, but they're managing all of it, but they're actually separate entities in the ownership. I was wondering, you know, it's kind of a that type of situation, in fact, is a mom and pop operation there. The pop does a lot of the maintenance around it and charges fees, or they work out arrangements, I suppose, or whatever, and the cleaning and everything. And I was wondering if we're going to, it seems that there's a lot of problems that could be, that could come up with, that this might put quite a burden on this type of people that may be supplementing their retirement income for different things,
Okay, that
grandfather clause or something. I don't know how to do it, but I thought
well,
it should be.
Well, first, Todd, what do we want to do? I have a similar concern, and section 88161, I've given you a copy of that, and it states here, unless licensed as a real estate broker, associate real estate broker, or real estate salesman, an actual person, and see this all in here now, form a domestic corporation, or partnership, or limited partnership, or other entities may not, and these are the things that they may not do, sell, exchange, or anything except for collect rent for the use of real estate. Now, it's going down. And then number nine here would be for compensation, managed commercial or real estate. And I think that's the question. Proposing to take out for compensation, but if you read it back in context, the person may not, unless they're a license as an associate broker, a broker, or whatever, may not manage commercial real estate. And then there was some additional language, or a condominium association, community association, or any other type organization which manage commercial or residential real estate. And I think your question is probably timely. How do you cover an owner unit who may want to delegate? It says here a natural person, which will say
hey,
a person who is not a real estate or not trained in that.
Our statutory construction, and by the way, this is somewhat unique in Alaska. It works better than most of the other states. Our statute says anybody in the whole world that's going to do anything with real estate has to be licensed. So it's an umbrella statute.
Mm-hmm.
Then in section 421, we have the exceptions to that.
So that's 88-421.
Let's send it. Let's get a copy for everyone. I'm going to have a copy of this. 421. I think you know, we need to look at this in context. But if we have to, I'm going to need to look at that. I need to read. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I do have to tell my daughter to read it. Let me ask you, this section, given the situation, I've put together a condo and 42 units. After they were sold, the owners essentially bought one of the units, and they hire a mom-pa, an elderly couple, to essentially keep the place clean and collect rents, and they have their own association, and they do that, and they let them live in that unit, and I think they pay them some money, too. You're saying, under this statute, they would have to essentially contract with a licensed broker to
no,
provide that service,
they,
and people would have to work for them? Or?
So there you would have the resident. 421 has, in fact, an amendment from last year provides an exception for a resident manager. So if the people reside in one of the units,
But don't own it,
they would still be accepted.
What if that same association chose not to do that? Maybe they hired somebody, again, a couple, to collect their condominium fees and pay the bill.
They would have to do that.
They would have to do that with a license group.
Yeah. And the reason for that, as I said, that what's happening is these associations often lack a great deal of sophistication. Condominium management can be very complex when you get into the fiscal stuff.
And managing budgets and things, and what's happening is a lot of these associations are being mismanaged and more serious than I think is embezzled. if we make an exception that they can go out and hire anybody off the street, then we will continue to have this problem of failure of the in the fiduciary relationship, and some of the losses are quite huge.
I got some real concerns on that.
Well, it's already in statute, so we have to deal with that. Let me recognize Representative Wingstead and then you.
On this, okay, if we're going to add this stuff that's in here, if I own a complex of apartments, and we've got 500 apartments, and I hire somebody to manage that, and I will have to hire a real estate.
So if you have a single complex, if they're all, I say one property description, and it's got 500 units on it, and you hire somebody to live in one of those units and manage it.
I didn't say live, but somebody's just going to manage it.
But if somebody is going to manage it who doesn't live there, that's already covered in the statute, by the way. They do have to be licensed.
So if I have a business, or if I go through and own apartments, like I said, not even one complex, apartments all over town, so yeah, I've got 100 apartments, you know, fourplex here, sixplex there, duplex someplace else. I have somebody that I hire just to manage my rental property. They have to be real estate licensed.
Yeah. Now let's be careful here in defining management, because there's two different kinds of management. One is what I call fiduciary management. If you're collecting rent and deposits, and a lot of people could say, well, it's my rent, so if I want to hire somebody and they steal the rent, that's my problem. That's true, but what if they steal a deposit and you can't make good on it? One of the largest scandals we had in Anchorage, one of the largest frauds, involved property management. And my estimate is that broker, in addition to what he was convicted of, got away with an additional $750,000 just in security deposits. It can be huge. If a person is collecting money, see, right now, in apartments, rental apartments, if a person is collecting the rent or showing the apartments and doing the leasing, we say that person must be licensed unless they are a resident manager. If the manager is responsible for things like, this is the person that gets called when the plumbing is up, or this is the person that gets called when the power goes off, or something like that, but they don't rent the units out, they don't handle the deposits and stuff, that is not what we're calling property management. That's not a fiduciary responsibility, that's a maintenance responsibility. So if you're talking about maintenance management only, that's a separate ballgame. Because if a condominium association even wanted to hire somebody to handle just the maintenance, but not handle their financial and fiduciary affairs, then we would not consider that a licensed activity. But once you get into handling those reserve accounts, managing the real estate aspect of the property and the financial aspect of the property, and not just, maintenance, then we feel there's a need for public protection, because we are seeing some pretty substantial losses to the public, because they get people who are incompetent.
John, if you'll read on the handout, which is good here, OAB 421, number 2, it states here, the person that has the exemption applies to a residential manager of rented real estate with the duties limited to the negotiation of lease and rental agreements and the collection of rent from use of the real estate, and if he is employed by the owner of the real estate, or employed by or engaged on the contract with the licensed real estate broker, so it appears to me there is an exemption there.
Yeah, stating resident manager. I've got someone, I've got a whole bunch of apartments that I'm renting out, and I can hire someone to do the maintenance of it, but I have to handle all the rent myself for hire a licensed broker.
Yeah.
at what point does that change? If I'm down, if I'm sitting here in Juneau and I'm letting my house out in Fairbanks, can I still pay my money for them?
You mean someone who's not living in the house? They have to be out. Or they have to be covered under the under.
I'm just thinking, maybe I could ask one question. In the case of an owner
Can an owner do whatever he wants, whatever he pleases to the property that he owns, to his own personal residence or a series of units?
But he makes the owner thing.
The owner can, yeah. The owner can, you want to delegate that to an employee or someone else under his responsibility as long as he maintains accountability?
Not entirely. Okay, if it's one, if it's a single family residence, let's say, the way I would recommend, if an owner called me and says, I have a house and I want my next door neighbor to take care of it while I move to California, I'd say, give him power of attorney. Single family back.
What if the owner has 50 units of apartment, or a congregated or 10 complexes?
Then I
got it over town.
Yeah, I would say that that person needs to be licensed. The person that they delegate it to needs to be licensed.
Does the law state,
unless they are a resident manager.
Does the statute state that that person, that the owner cannot hire an employee with those responsibilities as long as the owner maintains the accountability? He's accountable for those reserves, and not the reserves, but the
deposits.
Whatever.
Yeah, the law says that the owner can't do that.
He cannot do that.
Cannot do that.
If you want to attack that, then you do it another way. Let me, I'm sorry to take that. Let me recognize Greg.
Have a guy on.
I'm going to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about in the case where you've got, like, in a condominium association, you've got a president, a board of directors, and those type of people who have responsibility? Doesn't the responsibility, even though they were to let out that to a management firm, if they were to abscond with the money and so on, wouldn't that board of directors and the president of board of directors be ultimately responsible based on the legal agreement that was made up in the condominium association, the townhouse association, or what have you? So wouldn't that responsibility on reserves and anything that would be missing or money that would be lost or embezzled be the responsibility of that board of directors? And what would this do to change that kind of effect in law?
Okay, ultimately, a lot of the responsibility, as you correctly point out, does go back to the board of directors. The problem is that when the board of directors hires an incompetent or a dishonest manager and something happens, first of all, the board of directors, by the type of organization it is, i.e., it's a volunteer organization. You can get good boards of directors, and you can get boards of directors that are very weak. When you wind up with a couple $100,000 down the tube, and here sits the board of directors, do we then go out and spend another $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 suing them? And even if we do sue them, is there anything there to get once we sue them? Right now in Alaska, most of these boards of directors don't understand their liabilities and their responsibilities, and it's getting to be a very technical area. So yes, there is liability there on their part. And I guess part of what we're saying is they can be looked at as much victims as anyone else. All you're doing is saying that instead of the whole condominium sharing the loss, you might be able to narrow the loss down to the board of directors when they get a dishonest person in there.
Yeah,
there's
a follow-up question. Well, that's sort of interesting because I think that if you go back and look at the legal agreement that when these things are established, obviously the board of directors and the president of the association is voted in by the members. So what they're doing is they're putting their confidence, and I think from a legal standpoint, they're completely liable, as you pointed out, but
if you were in California, that would be true, but that's not true in Alaska. In Alaska, we've got a couple now. I've been receiving calls from attorneys. There's one association in Anchorage that just got hit with a $200-some a month additional assessment. And the reason it says there's no money in the account and they can't pay their bills and all this kind of stuff. And those people are getting hurt. The homeowner association, you know, the declarations were never properly drawn up or filed. They don't have bylaws. All they've got is, initial filing by the developer, which could include bylaws. See, there's no enforcement
of what little condominium sets that we have right now. And when people buy these things, they don't know what's supposed to be there. Basically, the things you're saying, people when they buy condominiums should know these things. Just like you should know every point of law that you need to defend yourself in court, but you don't. That's why you hire an attorney. So right now, we have a situation where we're dealing with a complex legal real estate creation with condominiums. And the people buying these things are not aware of it. The licensees selling them and managing them are often not aware of it. And it's causing some horrendous problems. I think in the next 3 years, you're going to see what I call a maturation of condominium problems in the areas where they have been built. It takes 5 to 10 years for a lot of these problems to suddenly blossom out. And I think an answer is in the next 2 years, actually, we're going to see just an absolute explosion of these problems. I've had several attorneys now calling me and saying, just wait, because I'm working on this one right now, and sooner or later it's going to hit your desk. And the losses are huge. It worries me, and I don't want to take the approach of drafting a condominium law which is 6,000 pages long. I'd rather take the approach of saying there is a select group of people here who have, by their option, elected to become expert in this, and therefore they are competent, professionally licensed, and
there is some liability protection. It's part of my concept of minimum regulation. I'm an anti-regulator, but when I see losses like this, and realizing that we are in a complex society, some regulation is necessary. Most of the other states have gone to just huge, complex condominium laws, and they're not all that effective either. We've been very effective in just saying, here's what you're responsible for, and if you mess up, you're going to pay.
But let me interject here, simply a time of perspective. We do have another piece of legislation, and ATC may have possibly two people that wish to be on record concerning that. I'd recommend we spend no more than another 10 minutes on this subject. Are you going to be in town tomorrow?
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So let's take about, we'll cut this off at a quarter till, and then I'd like to get into the ATC.
Okay, good.
Yeah, just one other follow-up question. We're talking about a surety fund here, is that correct?
Yeah.
And the amount of money that we're talking about that's going to be coming off the licenses, the proceeds is going to go into the surety fund, am I correct there?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that amount of money in that surety fund going to be enough to offset the number of problems that you're talking about as far as the
bankruptcy,
but the
embezzlement
of the fund.
I would say so. It looks that way. And that, I think we've covered 161. The basic intent of the commission when it discussed this type of a statute was not commercial or residential real estate, but condominiums. Okay, I just make that clear. You know, condominium associations. Now, let me just, section 251 is basically just a language cleanup, and I don't see any real need to go into that unless you have a particular question, because it's all just saying the same thing. It's just describing what's being done more accurately and making it clearer to people reading it. 291, in essence, the same thing. just making the procedures clearer in the language of the statute. Section 331, the addition of the words, and shall be supervised by the real estate broker. Many people have not understood what it means to process a transaction through the broker. And basically, I tell people that what this means is that anytime you deal with a licensed real estate person, you're entitled to the expertise of a broker. And that means that even if the licensee owns the property, the broker still must oversee the transaction, so you have that protection. By law, what I tell people is the law says that a salesman is not competent to carry out a full real estate transaction on his own without some supervision by the broker. That's why we have two types of licenses. So it's an equal competence standard, I tell people. Just because it's your own property doesn't make you more competent to do the paperwork. Right now, that supervision is enforced and enforceable, but this makes it clearer to those people reading the statute. Section B, which would be a new section, that 351, this is section 9, by the way, clarifies the record keeping for, you know, personal transactions by brokers and salesmen. And again, there's nothing new there, it's just clarification. In section 10, section 11 there was again meant to modify the section that we've been discussing at length, and it's meant to apply to residential commercial condominiums. And there should be a limitation on there. We do have a problem with developers that want to control these organizations long after the condominium units have all been sold, because they're the ones that can embezzle the money. And this is how they finance other projects and things. And there's one potential monster problem of that nature brewing right now in Anchorage. So here again, what that needs to say is the developer, until the units are sold or until the statutory time when they're supposed to turn it over to the homeowners association. And that's just an exception, so if the developer can start the homeowner association and do the things that need to be done. Section 12 simply says that the association itself and the board of directors don't have to be licensed. Oh, paragraph 12, excuse me. Okay, paragraph 12 is simply an exception for the association directors themselves if they don't hire a manager. Okay, now, section 11 now gets to the question that Representative Ewing just addressed, the actuarial viability of the fund. What is being proposed here? We currently have two limits on the fees that can be assessed. The limit is $40 on a salesman and $125 on a broker. There's no actuarial justification for this. We pay out just as much money, and the coverage is just the same for a salesman as for a broker. Therefore, what we are recommending is that the limit on the salesman be lifted to the same limit as we have on a broker, which is currently $125. Then the commission by regulation, and this is in the statute already, will set those fees to cover the expenditures from the fund. And the fund, by the way, has a ceiling on it out beyond which we can't build up anymore, and the ceiling is $500,000. So by adopting this amendment to the statute, we will raise the limits, and then by, yeah. Now, 250 is, there's two limits. 250 is the limit that must be kept in the fund for claims. If you go over 250, you can then use some of that money for educational programs, but you can't let the fund go over 500,000. And that extra 250 is basically our maneuvering room. If this amendment is adopted, then the commission would right now, according to my calculations, adopt the regulation setting a fee of about $100 for both brokers and salesmen. This would lower the broker fee about $25 right now, and it would raise the salesman fee from $40 to $100, about $60. This would bring in, right now, it would increase our revenues about $123,000 a year, and that amount would be a little bit over what our current rate of expenditures are. The fund is currently spending a little bit more than it's taking in, and this amount would either bring the fund back up to what it was a year ago within the next year or two, or
if we experience an increase in claims or something, we would have some, you know, some breathing room. The fund is not in trouble, but when it starts sliding, you can just draw a line to the year at which it's going to be broke. So this would bring it up. There's an additional benefit to this. I like to think that I'm a bureaucrat that spends state money like it was blood. Right now, having two different fees, you'd be amazed at the fee schedules that just that one little difference generates, because different people have different amounts. I was a salesman for the first half of the year. Now I'm going to a broker, so how much additional fee do I have to pay and everything? It creates a clerical headache and just costs money to process. If we have one fee, this would save several thousand dollars a year just in clerical time in our office. So I'm trying to make this thing bureaucratically efficient and also actuarially sound, and sound from a rational standpoint, i.e. everybody gets the same service, everybody gets the same coverage, everybody should pay the same fee.
Okay, let's have something referred to the rest of the presentation. There's a number of persons referred to. We're trying to get those questions.
Okay.
Malone, you have that.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Are we going to be through Mr. McGowan on this?
Yes, we will.
Okay.
I plan not to pass it up today. Trustee Copeland? Trustee Calvin?
No, I'll pass.
Well, what I would hope to do is we'll continue this through tomorrow. We'll take the first 15 minutes of the meeting to walk through the bill. We'll contact Mr. McGowan at 9 o'clock our time, 7 o'clock this time, and pose the additional questions. We'll send it on there. Okay.
Do you
know, do I need to be at the Legislative Affairs Office in the teleconference room?
No, we'll be in your office.
Okay.
If you'll leave it at home or whatever.
I'll give you the office.
You may want to give that number to Jeff. Give me a call. We have a speakerphone here that we can connect in, and the committee will be able to see if it's changed. That's being called. Is there anyone else to be heard on 389 at this point? If not, let's conclude. We'll hold this over. Let's go very quickly and do the the three bills, the 313 and 184.
Mr. Watson?
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Wilson, I'm sorry. Do you have testimony this morning? Yes, okay. You want to come on and break your view camera for me?
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Jim Wilson, WILSON, representing myself. And last week, in the joint committee, it was either one of the past commissioners or one of the existing commissioners, talked about two letters of intent from the House and the Senate 3 years ago, and that they contradicted each other. I don't know if you have copies of those or not. I made them available to your staff earlier, but I don't see the contradiction. The House clearly states that within these structures, is the committee's intent that the fit, willing, and able provisions be applied in a manner which allows for persons to make a reasonable showing of compliance, who make a reasonable showing of compliance to provide the service. And in the Senate letter, on the second page, says in a hearing on an issuance of a certificate under ASO 205070, the burden of showing that the proposed service is contrary that the public interest is on the person who opposes the issuance of the certificate on the grounds that the proposed service is contrary to the public interest.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 years ago, I testified in favor of ATC. I'm opposed to ATC today, mainly because of the way they have interpreted the legislation that was passed at that time. The only people that they're listening to are those that have certificates. The people that are trying to get a certificate can come in with contracts or work that will justify their business. And the existing operators come in and say it's going to take business away from us, so the certificates are turned down. As was pointed out, what, out of 33 applications, they've only issued 5 or 6, I believe, was the testimony that was given a week ago. The other thing, on air taxi certificates, there was a problem 3 years ago that they were giving limited authority. A person would be limited to a geographical area, type aircraft, and whatnot. And that was changed. Everyone was given an air taxi certificate with full authority. We have the same problem today in contract authority. Some people have contract authority for unlimited contracts. Munns Northern, I believe, is the one that has unlimited or many restrictions at all. Others are restricted to 5 contracts, others to 1, and in some cases they're restricting them to the specific make and model of aircraft. And in one case, they've got a person restricted to type aircraft that's suitable for stream survey. Well, I don't believe the commission has anyone on their staff that's qualified in determining what aircraft and what aircraft are not suitable for stream survey. I'd like to offer this time.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Are there any questions? Other people can take it. At least so. Thank you. Yeah, we've got 10 minutes here. Lois Cook, did you want to speak, or would you like to wait? We're going to carry this over through tomorrow, too. So, CJ? Okay, very good. Anybody else here to testify on 184? We'll take comments from the committee members and Powers.
Yes, I was at the last meeting. We had the Senate meeting of the Senate. With the Senate, it seems to me that there was some discrepancy in the testimony of one of the commissioners. They stated that following up, I think, of what the last witness was about the intent as to whether or not air taxi certificates may be issued if there's not enough business to warrant competition. In other words, the competition could be restricted. But if we can look at the House journals and the Senate journals from May the 23rd, 1980, it's quite clear that there is no conflict and that it's clear the intent is to issue a certificate to any operator that is fit, willing, and able. The only section in statutes 0205-010 that alludes to fostering sound economic conditions in air commerce, and that section has been repealed. So I think there was somewhat of discrepancy in the testimony that we heard the other day in the from the commissioners in the joint hearing.
Jeff, just a point of information. The statutes, the regulations, and everything was provided by the ATC. At that joint hearing, the chairman requested certain statistical data to also be provided. However, we have not received that. So it should be noted that the safety book and the rest of it they did provide, however, we still not received statistical data.
Anything further to be brought before the committee at this time?
Well,
yes, Representative Malone.
Yeah, going back to the testimony, Representative Chaudhry's remarks there, what Jeff said, the statistical data is what we're talking about, the applications and the decisions by the commission.
How many permits were issued under what circumstances, the temporary permits, for what durations, etc.
cetera, which they said how many cases they handled over the record year, but no break.
I'd like to have some statistics on the number of temporary suspension lines that suspend services and then re-enter, and information of how the commission looks on that. For example, I'm specifically thinking of the authority to fight in the interior to Juneau, which, or to White Horse, serves our area, and just suspended during the session. So
Jeff will look into that then between today and tomorrow, and we'll get some answers.
Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned.